This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
My solution to this was to fight, was to say no, that Zionism is racism, genocidal ideology, and it will always be a genocidal ideology, and there's no way of getting around that. And they don't like that very much, and so they come at you. And in this case, I'm very, very glad to say they have totally failed.
A UK government labour tribunal has ruled in favour of UK anti-Zionist academic David Miller.
Politicians do not get to dictate our healthcare. These suits do not get to dictate healthcare. And we do not have to send our taxpayer dollars to Israel to kill people and to bomb hospitals and to kill patients.
Healthcare workers and allies protest Nancy Pelosi for refusing to call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
During the apartheid era, we were able to force the U.S. administration to impose sanctions against South Africa. And that was the beginning of the end, when their chief ally turned against them because of our activism. The situation now is different because the Zionist lobby is so powerful.
Dr. Gerald Horn sheds light on the South African legal case against Israel, charging genocide in Gaza.
After we won the election, in the months to follow, Amazon fired hundreds of Amazon workers. And I believe that it was some type of a signal. You guys won an election, but if you support this union, you're going to be fired.
Amazon workers speak out about union busting. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. The UK's Bristol University fired Professor David Miller in October 2021, accusing him of anti-Semitism. Last week, a government labor tribunal ruled that he was fired for his work exposing Zionism. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I mean, my tribunal started on the 16th of October last year, so 9 days after the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood, when the Palestinian Resistance factions broke out of Gaza and launched that operation that they engaged in then. And during the tribunal, there was a lot of discussion from the university's council about my tweets about Al-Aqsa Flood and about the claims about the alleged beheaded babies and the mass rapes and the civilian casualties and all of that kind of thing, which I was, you know, along with many other people in independent media, questioning the propaganda which the Israelis had released. So it was a very kind of a strange time for the tribunal to happen. It had been 2 years in the making, but it starts just 9 days after Al-Aqsa Flood. And of course, there's a huge attempt by the university at that early stage to say that my views were terrible and not worthy of respect in a democratic society. They were, in the technical sense, akin to Nazism. And this was illustrated by my apparent support of Hamas and all this kind of stuff, right? So there's an attempt to do all that. But of course, as the time went on during the tribunal and the Zionist genocide in Gaza became more and more visible day after day to everyone around the world, that became a difficult circumstance for the university. And that's the backdrop to what happened. In the end, what happened, the judgment of the tribunal was that I had been wrongfully dismissed because the university had investigated me in a way which wasn't adequate. The person who investigated me in the end admitted they hadn't followed the proper rules. They hadn't investigated my side of the story. They'd only investigated the effect of my words on, or the alleged effect of my words on students. They hadn't investigated all the evidence and that I'd submitted to the inquiry. And the university witnesses also admitted effectively that they hadn't properly evaluated whether I should be sacked as a result of that investigation. So that I was wrongfully dismissed. And that, of course, is the key thing I was going for in the first place. But the more important element of the case, which is the second part of what we should talk about, was that I alleged that the reason that I had been sacked was that because of my anti-Zionist views, that it wasn't anything really to do with the reasons that the university gave. The university said the reason I was sacked was because students had been upset by what I'd said, that Zionist students had said they felt unsafe as a result of my anti-Zionist views. And it was those those effects of what I had said, which were the real reason for me being sacked. But when it came under cross-examination, both the person who investigated me and the person who sacked me effectively admitted that actually the really bad stuff that I'd done was the anti-Zionism. It wasn't the stuff about the students, it was the anti-Zionism. And the university's own witnesses effectively undermined the university's case that I had been sacked for these other reasons. And so that meant that the court decided that I had been sacked because of my anti-Zionist views, and also determined that the anti-Zionist views that I espoused were, to use the technical language, worthy of respect in a democratic society, and thus are protected philosophical beliefs under the UK Equality Act of 2010. So it's now illegal, based on the precedent of my case, to discriminate against people on the basis of their anti-Zionist views. So that's a huge breakthrough, and it will be available for everybody else in the UK in any job to defend themselves, not just academics, any job. People cannot be sacked now for being anti-Zionists. And that's the most important element of the case, and the most lasting element of it, which will go forward in the future.
One of the things that has been going on is an international effort of the Zionists to say that if you're critical of Israel, you're an anti-Semite. Is that contained also in this kind of campaign against you and other academics, that you're anti-Semitic because you're critical of Israel?
Of course. I mean, they've been trying to do this for a long, long time. I mean, the Israeli foreign minister, Abe Eban, famously said this in 1972, that anti-Zionism is the new anti-Semitism. It's not so much anti-Semitism of the old neo-Nazi type, which the Jews face. It's the anti-Semitism of anti-Zionism. And of course, they've been trying to encourage that notion ever since the 1970s, and in particular in the period since 2000, they've set up something called the Global Forum for Countering Anti-Semitism, which worked for years and years and is still working on blurring the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So that's their line. There's no distinction. And now the great thing about this case, though, is it's not just that it will protect people from being anti-Zionists, it also fundamentally undermines that key Zionist foreign policy talking point, which is that there's no distinction. There is a distinction. The courts have determined in the UK that there is a distinction, and that anti-Zionist views are worthy of respect in democratic society, i.e. they are not akin to Nazism and they are not racism. So that's a real coach and horses driven through that definition created by the Zionists and institutionalized in, of course, the 2016 adoption of the working definition by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which is of course the main weapon that they have used to beat the pro-Palestine movement in the past 8 or 9 years. So it's a coach and horses through that attempt to bring those two concepts together. And I don't know that it can survive that. So I think it's the beginning of the end of those kinds of propaganda notions that the Israelis encourage.
And you set up a research institute that began to investigate the relationship of the Zionists, the Israeli state, to propaganda and the influence of the public and the influence of society. What did your institute do, and why did they see that as such a threat to their public persona?
Actually, the organization I set up, Public Interest Investigations, which runs two websites, spinwatch.org and powerbase.info, was set up to examine, as the term spin watch tells you, to examine propaganda and spin in the wake of the Iraq war. And so we did a lot of work on government propaganda, yes, on lobbying and on corporate lobbying, on environmental public relations and greenwashing, and a whole range of things that were of interest to essentially the anti-globalization movement of the period. We only got into doing the Zionism thing much later, partly as a result of research we did on two neoconservative think tanks in the UK. We did this work because we were looking at the way in which they pushed Islamophobia. And so we examined them from the point of view of understanding why was Islamophobia being pushed in the UK. And it was these neoconservative think tanks that did it. And we looked at who had funded these think tanks. And one of the things we found was that there was all these obscure British charities, much like foundations in the US, which were funding the Islamophobia of these think tanks. And we didn't understand at the time, but these, in the end, we discovered, because we looked at what else they funded, were Zionist family foundations, much like the Zionist family foundations you get in the US, which fund Islamophobia, the Middle East Forum or whatever. So we only really started to understand that this was actually the Zionists were pushing Islamophobia, and we hadn't understood that before. And that took us off into direct examination of the Israel lobby, of the Zionist movement, the broader Zionist movement. And the thing which they didn't like, well, the thing which they complained about me, the first complaint in this process, I started at the University of Bristol in 2018, and in February 2019, I gave a lecture on Islamophobia where I spent a short time in the lecture talking about the role of Zionism based on this research in pushing Islamophobia. And they just really didn't like that because they styled themselves as being anti-racist. So they couldn't have it said that they were actually driving anti-Muslim racism in the UK, which of course they are. And so that was the thing which led to their first complaint. And, and as a result, because I wouldn't back down, I wouldn't apologise, they really hated me. And they, as you can see on social media, they continue to really hate me. And that's the lesson of this, though, if that's the question what this question leads to, the lesson is that, you know, that when you're faced with the vitriol and the intimidation and the bullying and the trolls and the lies and the smears from the Zionists and their myriad of organizations in the US and the UK and elsewhere, the way to beat them is not to apologize and try and be reasonable and try and negotiate with them, because that never, never, never works. The way to deal with this is to fight, is to say, I'm an anti-racist, you are the racists, and we will not be called racists by these actual racists, and to fight back against them. And that's what I've done. And it's been difficult. I lost my job. I lost my means of earning a living. I can now never get a job in British academia, even having been cleared. I think it's unlikely. So there was a real attempt to destroy me as an individual. But I there was no choice for me once we engaged in this process. I was saying things which were based on my research. I couldn't pretend that the research didn't say that. And so my solution to this was to fight, was to say no, that Zionism is racism, and it always will be racism, and it's a genocidal ideology, and it will always be a genocidal ideology, and there's no way of getting around that, and they don't like that very much, and so they come at you. And in this case, I'm very, very glad to say they have totally failed.
One of the things that most Americans are unaware of is that the invasion of Iraq and the campaign to invade Iraq was financed by think groups, by Zionists who wanted the United States to invade Iraq. And this has continued now with Israel wanting the United States to go to war with other countries as an accomplice. What is the relationship of this propaganda to imperialist war that's going on now and the danger of a world war?
Well, I saw that Tucker Carlson, I think today, has made a statement about the way in which Netanyahu is a massive threat to world peace, and that the Americans should really invade Israel and take down the Zionists. What's, I think, interesting about this period is that this is the kind of thing which the left would not even say as much as that. But this used to be a left-wing position, more or less. But now we've got the sections of the American right are coming around to the idea that actually that Israel is not a benefit. It's not the on the leash attack dog used by US imperialism. It's actually off the leash. And it's actually a threat to U.S. imperial interests, never mind the interests of peace and security of West Asia and indeed of the rest of the world. So I think that we're starting to see the unraveling of the Zionist project, which at the level of both of the kind of the debate about this, so the sections of the American right coming around to the position that the left has had that Zionism is racism and is anti-Muslim. But at the same time, we also see directly in occupied Palestine that the Zionists are losing the military struggle against the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. They're losing, are scared of going into to Lebanon to take on Hezbollah, who the last time this happened, Hezbollah beat them, and Hezbollah is way more militarily significant now than it was then. They're also, of course, facing the threat from Yemen and the boycott that Ansar Allah have effectively imposed on them, and even the Americans, their key ally, are a bit scared of taking on Ansar Allah directly, which is pretty extraordinary. So we're living in a period where all of these things are coming together. So the pushback against Zionism is beginning to start. And of course, people will say to me, "Well, look what happened at Penn. Look what happened at Harvard. Look at all the people who've been sacked." And I take all that. They're doing very well with having people sacked, and they are pushing forward to squash the space for debate in Palestine. But we equally are pushing back. And the reason we're pushing back so successfully, I think, is that millions and millions of people for the first time see that the stuff that we've been saying for years, that Zionism is genocidal, is just straightforwardly and obviously true. And that genie cannot be put back in its box. The mask has slipped. The Israelis are actually trying to encourage us to believe the worst possible things about them by their actions. It's quite clear that they're doing this deliberately. So that can't go back in its box. So we're facing the very real possibility of the collapse of the whole of the Zionist project. And that's, I think, something which we should all be optimistic about.
That was fired Bristol University professor David Miller on his victory at a government labor tribunal, which ruled that his firing was unjust.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation. How could they be so evil, making mortars out of children and innocent people? We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed, but nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't feel scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be in my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall.
That was MC Abdul shouting at the wall. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Over 400 healthcare workers in Gaza have been bombed and murdered by the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF. Healthcare workers in the U.S. have been organizing nationally to get medical organizations to oppose the U.S.-supported genocide in Israel. On Friday, February 9, healthcare workers and others rallied outside the San Francisco Marin Medical Society's annual gala at the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, where Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi and California State Senator Scott Wiener were in attendance. The society has ignored its members' pleas to oppose the genocide.
My name is Rami Ibrahim, and I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement. So the San Francisco Marin Medical Society is hosting their annual gala here today. They're having Senator Scott Wiener and Representative Nancy Pelosi here, two of the largest political hacks for Israel and the Zionist state. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi is taking $13 million out of the streets of San Francisco, straight to Israel, to drop bombs on hospitals and doctors. They're able to write blank checks to Israel and to fund and support genocide. In addition to that, you're seeing hundreds of billions of dollars go to Ukraine, and they're able to pull that right out of their back pocket, but are not able to fund basic needs and healthcare services for the people in the city who live here and struggle every single day.
And the US media and the US politicians shamelessly echoed the lie that the Palestinians bombed their own hospital. Now, 125 days into this genocide, there are no operational hospitals in Gaza. To hear us. There are no functioning hospitals in Gaza. 400 healthcare workers in Gaza have been murdered by the genocidal Israeli occupation. And every U.S. politician who has voted to give money and funding and weapons and political cover for Israel is also complicit in genocide. Is complicit in genocide, they don't have the power to enforce their result.
but we do. We have followed these politicians around every day during this genocide, and we're not gonna stop.
I work at St. Francis Hospital in the burn unit here in San Francisco. I also work at San Leandro Hospital in San Leandro. I've been a respiratory therapist for 20 years. So it's really upsetting to me because every healthcare worker that's dining with Nancy Pelosi and Scott Wiener tonight should be ashamed of themselves. We celebrated all the healthcare workers during COVID, and now we're killing them in Palestine. Absolutely not. And so we need to send a message to all the politicians, everybody, that they mess with the wrong healthcare workers. And we're not going anywhere. We're not leaving the Palestinian people behind. We are going to haunt them wherever they go. At the airport, at the museum, at dinner. They cannot celebrate, they cannot eat, they cannot travel until they call for a ceasefire and to end the killing of our Palestinian brothers and sisters. This has been going on way too long and I'm tired of it. It's time to use the strong language. It's time to not back down. It's time to hold these people accountable. And they cannot tell us we don't understand. When we see injuries in the hospital, we deal with sick and dying people all the time. And it's much worse for those in Palestine who have no medication, no anesthesia, no infection control. So this is not gonna happen anymore. Not on our watch. We didn't even sign up for this. So these politicians do not get to dictate our healthcare. These suits do not get to dictate healthcare. And we do not have to send our taxpayer dollars to Israel to kill people and to bomb hospitals and to kill patients. That's it.
Those were the voices of healthcare workers and others protesting Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, California State Senator Scott Wiener, and the San Francisco Marin Medical Society's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza. Next, J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio interviewed internationally renowned historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn about the South African legal case charging Israel with genocide at the International Court of Justice in The Hague.
And we just want to get updated on the world events that are taking place. It's a very hot time. You talked a little bit about it in your recent lecture that you just had. The International Court of Justice is who convicted Israel of genocide. What does that mean? What are the ramifications for Israel? And can you talk about it being in the Court of Justice and not the International Criminal Court?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Second of all, the International Court of Justice in The Hague has oversight over cases emerging out of the Genocide Convention of 1948-1949. It adjudicates disputes between states. South Africa brought a case against Israel with regard to Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza. The International Court of Justice, in an overwhelming majority, viewed that South Africa made out a plausible case for genocide. In order to say that Israel has committed genocide, that'll take many months, perhaps even years, to accumulate the evidence to make that case. The International Court of Justice also suggested that Israel take immediate steps to ameliorate the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. There are those who have interpreted their decision to suggest that the only way to ameliorate the catastrophe is to have a ceasefire. Now, of course, the International Court of Justice did not call explicitly for a ceasefire. but it's fair to interpret their ruling in that light. Of course, the evidence that was presented by South Africa was overwhelming in terms of what they called reproductive violence. That is to say, the fact that the infant mortality rate amongst Palestinian women is skyrocketing. In terms of hunger, at one point, it was adjudged that of the 80% of the cases of famine, extreme hunger in the world, were centered in Gaza, which only has a population of 2.2 million. So this was a very powerful case. You ask why it wasn't brought before the International Criminal Court, also in The Hague. Part of the reason is the International Criminal Court has dropped the ball. They have become really a tool of the North Atlantic powers. You might have noticed that disproportionately and overwhelmingly, they bring cases against leaders of Africa, right. Interestingly enough. George W. Bush has not had to stand before the International Criminal Court, nor has his sidekick, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, et cetera. The International Court of Justice is a more balanced court to that degree, and we can expect Israel to come back to the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, within maybe 3 weeks with a report outlining how they have sought to ameliorate the humanitarian disaster. I don't think that their report will be satisfactory because you know that since the ICJ rendered their opinion, they've still been massacring people. And so what that suggests is that the case will be then referred to the United Nations Security Council, where the U.S. government will probably veto any measure. It can then go to the General Assembly, 190 plus member states of the United Nations, and depending on the language they craft that they can get an overwhelming majority to sign on to, this could form a basis for further sanctions against Israel. I say further sanctions because probably the most effective sanctions thus far against Israel have come from Yemen, where the comrades there have been launching missiles at vessels headed towards Israeli ports, which is obviously hampering the Israeli economy, which is in free fall right now. So if you look at the parallel campaign against apartheid South Africa, you'll see many relevant comparisons. For example, at a certain point, South Africa was expelled from the United Nations. There are those who are calling for Israel to be expelled from the United Nations. In other words, to further isolate and marginalize this current outlaw regime. The problem, of course, is the U.S. government, their major protector. During the apartheid era, we were able to force the U.S. administration to impose sanctions against South Africa. And that was the beginning of the end, when their chief ally turned against them because of our activism. The situation now is different because the Zionist lobby is so powerful. The apartheid lobby could not hold a candle to the Zionist lobby in terms of power and influence. As you know, people are losing their jobs because of the Zionist lobby. People are afraid to speak out. So this is going to be a very tough and difficult battle, but I'm confident that we'll prevail.
In looking at what happened with South Africa in the divestment movement, how effective do you think a divestment movement will be in terms of dealing with Israel and its genocide right now?
Well, it has a lot of potential, but as you know, potential means you haven't done it yet. But it's already in motion. You have a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But interestingly enough, just to draw the comparison, in states like Arkansas, if you want to, say, come speak at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, you have to sign a statement saying you're not in favor of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, for example. We did not have something like that during the apartheid era.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I was going to say that the Zionists are way more ingrained into the social structure of what's going on in America than their counterparts in South Africa. So then how would it be effective? Because you have everything from coffee shops to the record industry that are very much influenced by Zionist Israel. How do you see that being accomplished today?
I mean, you mentioned coffee shops. I mean, Starbucks is under pressure, is being boycotted in West Asia and the so-called Middle East. McDonald's, ditto. Coca-Cola, ditto. There's a lot of pressure on these major corporations because they're not just U.S. corporations. They have holdings all over the world. And fortunately, there's a world majority that's against Israel's outlaw regime. And so that's a lot of where the pressure is going to come from. And I think that ultimately, Israel will have to bow to that pressure, just like South Africa had to bow to that pressure.
The momentum that is being gained around Gaza, how do we use that momentum to stop the genocide in the Congo or to stop the century-long intervention into Haiti? How do we use this momentum to stop it?
Well, it's a difficult question, but obviously the kind of infrastructure we build up in terms of organization to pressure Israel, that infrastructure is transferable to apply to the Congo, to apply to Haiti. Now, of course, sadly, the examples are not very positive. I mean, we had this entire anti-apartheid Southern Africa solidarity infrastructure, but after South African independence in 1994, it tended to dissolve. That's not encouraging in terms of trying to use this anti-Zionist infrastructure for these other campaigns that you mentioned. But hopefully what can happen is that we'll learn the lessons of the past. Obviously, the key to a lot of these problems and a lot of these questions that you raise comes back to organization. It comes back to organizing. It comes back to mass pressure. And sadly, we don't have enough of that in the United States.
That was historian Dr. Gerald Horn speaking to J.R. Val Ray of Block Report Radio. Horn is the author of more than 30 books, including his most recent work, I Dare Say, and Acknowledging Radical Conversations.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs.
That was Bob Marley's Redemption Song. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Amazon Fulfillment Center, JFK 8, in Staten Island, New York, is the first warehouse where workers voted for a union. They voted for the Amazon Labor Union to represent them, defeating a major union-busting attack. The vice president of the local, Michelle Valentin Nieves, spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Conditions there are just horrendous. It's literally like a modern-day plantation. There's no conversation between management and the actual workers. You know, there's no good morning, how are you, good afternoon. They only talk to you if you're going to get a write-up or if you haven't been making rate. So you're looked at more as a number than an actual human being. Sometimes the write-ups are not being communicated with the actual worker, so they don't realize it until an HR rep or HR rep combined with a security guard come to tell you that you're terminated, and then you're escorted out of the building. It's a very traumatizing experience because workers feel like they're being criminalized, especially when, you know, you've been working for a company and you've been working very, very hard for 2 or 3 years. And then one day you're just escorted out of the building as if you're some kind of a criminal. So I've seen it happen many times, many, many times. Multiple OSHA violations on every single floor, as far as you can see, Department of Labor violations, you know, managers interfering with you using the restroom. They track us according to what we're doing. So when you go into the building, you scan in the building with a badge. And with that badge that has your employee ID number, they can track everything that you're processing or doing because you're doing it underneath that badge. Once you sign in and you scan in, they're tracking all of your scans. So if you leave the station to go use the restroom and you stop scanning, it sends like a little message to the area managers because they're constantly checking people's numbers and people's productivity. And they'll come to the station Sometimes when you haven't returned to the station yet. So when you return to the station, there's actually a manager there waiting for you, and they'll start questioning you as to why did you leave the station. And it's very, very difficult because it's like the managers don't understand that it's illegal to interfere with the employees using the restroom, right? So if I come back to the station and I say, well, I stopped scanning for 8 minutes because I was using the restroom, the conversation is supposed to end there, but the conversation doesn't end there. You know, they start in where, you know, well, you have a break in about an hour. Is there any way that you can hold off until you go on break? So they give us like this little 15-minute break. It's a paid break, but it's only 15 minutes up to pretty much, I guess, everyone's supposed to go use the restroom or grab some water or whatever it is. So the restroom use, the harassment that I received when I was trying to use the restroom was one of the first red flags that I noticed initially when I was first hired the first few months. I had never been asked about restroom use in any of my other jobs. So this was very shocking to me at that time. Yeah, so JFK 8 is one of the largest facilities in the Amazon network. Apparently, it's the size of 3 football fields if you measure it all the way around. So it is quite a walk to get to the restroom. And even if you walk quickly, it's at least a 4-minute to 5-minute walk just to get to the restroom. Especially with the ladies' restroom, there's always a line, because everyone goes on their break and then you have to wait online to use the restroom, and then you have to try and walk back. So technically you're not taking a break at all. They're just giving you 15 minutes to use the restroom. It absolutely feels like a plantation. I have several friends and coworkers that have been injured. So usually it's injuries from repetitive motion. So it's the wrist, the rotator cuff in the shoulders, and a lot of sciatic nerve damage, which is in the lower part of your back, from constantly lifting and moving in the same position, lifting the heavy totes, putting down the heavy totes, lifting in a heavy product, putting it onto the conveyor. So when you're doing this for hours and hours at a time, it's usually the repetitive motion injuries that we see. So we did retain a workers' compensation attorney that has been helping. But even, you know, with that, the injury rate just hasn't improved, unfortunately. I've been there 5 years, and I am capped out at $22.75. And that's after being with this particular location for 5 years. So there is a population of homeless workers in JFK 8. We do have some workers that actually sleep in their cars. There's some workers that sleep in their cars in the parking lot. Living out of their cars. We have some that are living with family. We have some that are renting rooms, and you just pay weekly for the room that you're renting. So there's also a housing crisis for these Amazon workers as well, because the pay just doesn't allow you to be sustainable and to live independently in New York City with the outrageous rents and the cost of living now in New York City. There was some literature going around. So I first spotted a few pieces of literature in the cafeteria. And then there were a few organizers in my department, and I, you know, struck up a conversation with one of the organizers. And then I just started volunteering and showing up to meetings, and that was it. And then after that, I just got really, really deeply involved with organizing and trying to get people to vote to become unionized so that we can try and fight back and have some type of collective power against management and the Amazon company's leadership and the millionaires and the billionaires that are running the company. And then they flew in a team of union busters, you know, to just throw a wrench in everything that we were trying to do. The union busters, I'd say it was about anywhere from 8 to 11 union busters that were flown in. And they would walk around the building, the facility, and they would go to worker stations and talk to them about anti-union propaganda. So why, you know, is the ALU a third party, you know, organization? What are member dues? You know, that the ALU is just trying to get your member dues. They're a business. They're just trying to make money. You should try to work on your relationship with your manager, and your manager can help you at work. You don't need a third party organization such as a union to come in and help you. We were also subjected to captive audience meetings where we were exposed to images and verbiage that were anti-union images and verbiage. We were exposed, I believe, to over 3,000 captive audience meetings in about 1 to 2 months' time. So it was extremely aggressive, very strategic anti-union, union busting that was coming from Amazon corporate, which is the managers and leadership. So it was all of them combined. And then they would have these union busters that would come in on rotation. So one would cover the day shift and then one would cover the night shift. And then they had like three or four of them that were just walking around the entire facility pretty much on a 24-hour basis. Later on, we came to find out that I believe they spent about $11.4 million on union busting just on JFK 8 alone. So just on our location and our facility, they spent about $11.4 million on union busting. You know, the lack of support that we received from politicians and influential people was very, very apparent during this whole process. So we knew that there was no cavalry coming. So we were just basically on our own. And that's all we had. We had a few boxes of paper, some pens, some paper clips, and that's it. We had no money. We had no resources, no support, a shoestring budget. And you know, we were still able to do it. But again, I feel that we were able to do it because we were doing it for over a year. So it was a very, very, very long process of trying to organize all of these Amazon workers. Also, there was a huge firing spree that Amazon went on after we won the election. So after we won the election, in the months to follow, Amazon fired hundreds of Amazon workers. And I believe that it was some type of a signal that they were sending to the workers, like, okay, you guys won an election, but if you support this union, you're going to be fired. We're just letting you know. So that was a way of, you know, sending this message to the workers to please don't get involved with the union because you're going to be fired. So a lot of the Amazon organizers have been picked off one by one. So everyone knows that Christian Smalls was fired over 3 years ago. Just recently, I'd say about maybe 2 months ago, Connor Spence was also fired from Amazon. So that's what they're doing. They're just, you know, little by little, one by one, they're going to try to pick off all of the leaders so that there's no one there to actually represent the union inside of the facility. To me, I mean, it's just going to take like a massive stop of production in the country. You know, I think that everyone is just going to have to eventually band together and just wake up one day and just refuse to go to work.
That was Michelle Valentin Nieves, vice president of the labor union at Amazon Fulfillment Center, JFK 8, on Staten Island, New York, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was the Chi-Lites, Give More Power to the People. Next, Pacifica's Don DeBar takes a look at one Central American country that has made some remarkable progress in the past decade. Today we take a look at the Sandinista Republic of Nicaragua. It's the largest country in Central America. It's relatively small on the world stage with a population of just under 7 million people. It happens to be the adopted home of our regular contributing journalist, Stephen Sefton, and it is also one of the places where another of our contributing journalists, Camila Escalante, hangs her hat.
For a long time, I've been thinking that we might discuss why Nicaragua is a very important country, in my opinion. Obviously, I'm going to have that opinion because I live here and I've devoted my life to working in Nicaragua in community development. And I've watched all through, really since 1994, when I first started working seriously in community development at grassroots here. I've watched how Nicaragua has changed from being practically a basket case under the previous neoliberal governments that ran Nicaragua from 1990 to the end of 2006. And I've watched the country change since January 2007, when Comandante Daniel Ortega and his partner Rosario Murillo took over the government. It would be wrong to say that they took power, because back then the opposition still remained extremely powerful. But I've watched since January 2007 how the country has completely transformed into probably the most successful country in Central America in terms of its overall development and progress. And there's one fundamental reason for that, and that is that Nicaragua completely rejected the neoliberal Washington consensus model that has been touted for so long and is still being touted by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. You know, and the usual recipe of opening up the economy as much as possible, cutting back public expenditure drastically, privatizing anything that was run by the state. And the only element of that Nicaragua has taken up is to open up its economy as much as possible. But with the difference that they are genuinely opening up their economy to diversify their international and trade relations with the whole world. And for example, they've just over the last year or so, negotiated and completed and ratified a free trade agreement with China. Which has completely transformed their commercial opportunities and made them practically invulnerable to the kind of unilateral coercive measures that the United States has used with such success in recent years against many countries around the world. I think the total number of countries suffering those kinds of illegal measures with coercive measures that lots of people call sanctions is now, what is it, well over 30 countries, something like that, around the world, including even ridiculously the People's Republic of China. But anyway, that's for another program perhaps. So what are the main elements of Nicaragua's unique model in resistance to this overwhelming pressure that the United States and its allies like to apply to developing countries, especially small developing countries like Nicaragua? And the main elements have been an insistence on food sovereignty and food security. Nicaragua has developed its agricultural and livestock production to the point where they're 90% self-sufficient in their food supply. They've completely rejected having anything to do, or as little as possible to do, with the United States in terms of security issues. So they are the most successful country in Central America and probably the region in regards to their success in combating drugs trafficking and organized crime. They've built up an extremely successful, the best public health system, certainly in Central America and probably in most of the region. I know that I think we were looking at the figures, I think, before we started our conversation. I think they've got something like 75 major regional hospitals and local hospitals in the public sector, far more than, for example, Costa Rica. And so you have this series of policies covering all sectors of national life in complete opposition to the kind of recipes that the United States and its allies like to impose on other countries in the region. And that has made Nicaragua one of the, in my opinion, certainly the most successful country in Central America, and perhaps among the most successful countries in all of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Camila, is this a portable model?
Well, it seems like some countries are going in the opposite direction, and one of the most important examples that we have of that today is Ecuador. Another one is Argentina. But the United States, actually under Trump, but continuing under Biden, announced what their strategy was going to be in the countries of the Americas among the so-called Western Hemisphere and what their what the framework was. And they have said that part of their whole scheme of promoting democracy and human rights and all of that is that they're going into these countries to promote a market-friendly culture. And they've said things like they're going to increase the awareness of the downside of non-market-based financing. And they're trying to go into these different countries like Ecuador right now to build closer ties between the United States and the private sectors of Ecuador. And really what's going on is that they're privatizing the healthcare system and other things that were made to be more accessible, education, things that were improved drastically under the model that was implemented by Rafael Correa, the former president. And we're really going backwards in these countries in terms of access to these different services. And so they're quite literally doing the opposite of what Nicaragua is doing, whereas Nicaragua is trying to make life more equitable, give people more rights, higher quality of life, lower cost of living, and all of that. We're seeing the opposite in these countries that are now being taken over by the United States.
And I think one of the fundamental things about Nicaragua is that, and whatever the international media may say in their false reporting about Nicaragua, the main characteristic that I've seen over the last 20 years is the way in which Nicaraguan society under the Sandinista government here has become much more democratic. And I think the democratization of Nicaraguan society has been absolutely key in enabling the Nicaraguan society, the Nicaraguan economy, to develop in such a positive way and create conditions which, as you say, are improving the lives of people here rather than the population finding themselves subject to the kind of economic repression. And in Argentina's case and in Ecuador's case, of course, the actual security forces repression, the resistance to those US-inspired policies are inspiring in those countries. So and I think democratization is the key concept that has enabled Nicaragua to be so successful.
So the question will now be whether or not we're going to see some of these sorts of things adopted in neighboring countries, specifically El Salvador. We have an election just passed. Nayib Bukele has now declared himself president once again of El Salvador. And he won because of some of the approaches he had implemented into solving crime, getting gangs off the streets, lowering the rates of daily homicides and violent crime. But we've yet to see the implementation of any sorts of policies that would bring about better healthcare, education, and basic rights to people and the democratization you're talking about. So I think this will be the real question, is whether or not these popular leaders who have won overwhelmingly in the polls, including Xiomara Castro, including Gustavo Petro, whether they will be able to follow the same sort of model as Nicaragua and have success.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing in El Salvador presumably is the stage being set for development. You know, when people stop shooting each other in the streets and such, but what's going to come next? We still don't know. So thank you both.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Don.
That was Pacifica's Don DeBar speaking to Nicaragua-based journalists Stephen Sefton and Camila Escalante. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Akua Holt, Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.